It's All Things Considered on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.
My mother was a hillbilly from Tennessee by way of Indiana. My father was and is a Jew from Schenectady. I'm not sure I'd have known I'd be forever split between Gentile and Jew had they not divorced when I was 2 years old. Thereafter, I was a Jew on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and every other weekend, and my mother's the rest of the week. Jew days and my father's apartment across the river from my mother's house in Scotia meant SpaghettiOs, kosher salami on Triscuits, and, on holidays, chopped livers at my Aunt Rosalind's. It seems to me now that the rest of the time we went to the movies, although I can only remember two, Excalibur and Hair. My Goyisha mother also took us to the movies. She found a job baking cookies and brownies for a concession stand at our town's movie theater, rehabilitated by a band of hippies who didn't want to peddle corporate candy. My fourth summer, while my mother baked, I played in the theater. On the sunniest of days, I sat in the dark eating warm cookies and watching reverently as the hippies threaded the two movies they owned through the projector over and over, Woody Allen's Sleeper and Harold and Maude. This constitutes my early Jewish education.
Your upbringing was, as you write in this essay, kind of a confusing one from a religious standpoint. You wrote that you identified as Jewish in school, even though at the time you weren't really sure what that meant. What were some of the obstacles you encountered as someone who was not quite sure where you fit on a religious spectrum?
Well, in my little town of Scotia, New York, probably the most literal obstacle was kind of a pretty virulent anti-Semitism, and I sort of get into that a little bit in that essay. But more, I don't think I ever felt it as an obstacle. You know, I like to say that my mother raised me unreligious in as many churches and ashrams and compounds and temples as we had friends, and we would sort of follow the music. If she had a friend who sang in this choir, that's where we go. Friend over here ringing bells, that's where we go. And it had never occurred to me, I think, as a child, that one had to commit in this essay about being a half Jew in a not very tolerant little town. The confusion was this idea that a lot of people around me had, that identity was a very fixed and rigid thing, and you could only be one sort of thing at a time, and that wasn't my experience.
Your new book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, isn't so much about religion with a capital R as it is about spirituality on a much more subtle, personal level. How do you define the difference between religiosity and spirituality?
I'm not fond of the word spirituality. And I would say, yes, religion without a capital R. That's where I'd put it, just as you said. I think that's just right. I feel too often spirituality becomes a kind of a euphemism for, I don't want to think too hard about this thing. And I don't want to think too hard about this thing because the answers are not going to be clear as with this mixed up upbringing I have. You're not going to say, X plus Y equals, there's no solution to that problem. So I do actually veer toward religion, and especially religion contains, and that very idea contains within it, the idea of history. That if we acknowledge, if we're believers that we're religious people, or if we're not believers that we're not religious people, we are positioning ourselves with in relationship to whole wonderful and dark and fascinating and complex histories to which we are in ways accountable. And I think spirituality, that term, and I understand why it's so appealing to many of us. There's good reasons to get away from those histories, but I'm a writer. I'm in favor of facing history.
The subtitle of the book is Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. What is that country in between, and who populates it?
I think, again, it's sort of making a case for the kind of the hybridity of everyday life. We are all a mix of things. But it's also, I think, rooted in this idea of liberty of conscience. One of my favorite experiences over the years of wandering the country and talking to people about what they believe, don't believe, almost every religious tradition I've encountered, people say they believe in free speech. Now, believing in free speech and practicing it are very different things, but they believe in it. And they usually say it's because it's in our tradition. It's in the Bible. It's in our holy books. No, it's not. This is one of the remarkable things about the United States, is that we sort of made this idea of free speech sacred, read it into our religious traditions where it doesn't really exist, And that puts us forever in this kind of, to me, a very redemptive space. And I think purity, the idea of a kind of religious purity, of national purity, that's what's always frightening to me. And this kind of mixing free speech into the stew puts us in a country in between that can never be wholly one thing or the other.
An analysis from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life shows that Americans in their 20s, the so-called millennials, millennial generation, believe in some of the big picture aspects of mainstream religion, like belief in the afterlife, moralistic rights, moralistic wrongs. But in other areas, such as church participation, young adults show far less involvement than their older generations. Do you think that signals, as some have indicated, a decline in the religiosity of the country, or more, is it more of an evolution into another state of religiosity for the 21st century?
I think you're closer with the latter, and I think those kinds of numbers often get misread. I remember my last book called Sea Street, I wrote about politicized fundamentalism in the military, and I mean to distinguish politicized fundamentalism from those who are just very conservative in their faith. And I managed to get a hold of numbers on religious breakdown from the Pentagon, which at first denied that they had such numbers. In fact, turns out they have them down to a single man or woman in the military. But they had this huge number of those who reported themselves not religious. And as I was traveling around talking to military personnel, a lot of those people who said they're not religious are devout evangelicals. And this goes back to your question about spirit. You know, they see religion as a bad word. So I don't think religiosity is declining. I think that term is certainly falling out of favor. But as you said, other numbers indicate a kind of, if anything, a ever-increasing kind of involvement with what can only be called religious questions, regardless of which term we want to use to describe them.
If what you're saying is true, that perhaps the term and the traditional definition of religiosity is declining, what's going to replace it?
I don't know. I think one of the interesting things I've encountered in my years of writing about religion, for a long time I was writing about fundamentalism and conservative evangelicalism, and it was almost on a two-year cycle with my colleagues in the press declaring it all over. That's all gone, that's no longer an influence in American life. And really that cycle goes back, not quite on the two-year basis, back to 1925, the Scopes monkey trial, down evolution trial here in Tennessee, and after which nearly every paper in the country said, that's it for fundamentalism, it's gone. We are moving in an ever more secular direction. And yet we haven't. And you've seen that in the sort of the litmus test of political life playing out over and over and over. And now here we are in 2012, and Rick Santorum coming on strong with a very traditional kind of Christian conservative politics. And what's coming, I think, may not be as different from what's come before. It may be a change in terminology. But those old tensions in American life, they don't just wither away.
Religious belief crosses from the personal realm into the very public realm in an election year. That has been happening for decades now. When you see the arguments play out on television over who's more religious, who's the right kind of religious, who's the wrong kind of religious, coming from presidential candidates on both sides, what goes through your mind as an observer of religious practices and beliefs in this country?
Despair. it's such a silly line of reasoning and a very cynical one. But it's a great temptation. It's a temptation both to liberals and conservatives to say that this expression it's not true religion. And that's certainly, because I've written a lot about fundamentalism, liberal readers of my work and who like it say, oh, I like it. Those people aren't real Christians. That's not for us to say. You might say you disagree with their Christianity or their Judaism or their kind of Islam. But there's this strange kind of true-false kind of thinking about it, and it's so much less interesting than the reality of religious life. Rick Santorum's recent statement that Barack Obama's Christianity was a phony theology, that it's somehow false. Well, that's this kind of uninteresting way of looking at the religious evolution of a man who came from a fairly unreligious place, went through the kind of liberationist crucible of Jeremiah Wright's church, and has now moved into this much more centrist kind of evangelicalism almost, even though he's not an evangelical. That's fascinating. That's an American story. That's a complex story, the way these things aren't static. And it would be lovely to hear our politicians recognize that great dynamic energy in our life.
Does putting so much emphasis on a candidate's sort of basic religious beliefs take the focus away from the weightier, more complicated topics? In other words, does it essentially become misdirection during a political campaign to change the flow of the dialogue to something else?
On that score, no, I don't think it necessarily does. And I think, stay with Rick Santorum, who's always been a fascinating character to me, and he recently said JFK's famous speech on separation of church and state made him want to vomit. Those are strong words. And he said, how could I separate my faith from my politics? I don't agree with his position, but I think that's a legitimate position. I think it's interesting that he's stating it. And I think for a long time, American political life, we've never had much of a separation of church and state in the United States. It's just never been there. But at times it's named and at times it's not named. And it's almost sort of exciting when you see politicians, whether you share their politics or not, naming what they're doing, acknowledging what they're doing, and forcing us to have that conversation about, well, what is the relationship between belief and politics? Are these things separable? Are they not? Are they informing the ways in which we're making decisions about our lives? And that's certainly true on the everyday level as well as the grand national stage.
For at least the past decade that I've been able to find, there's been a persistent feeling among some Christians that they are a persecuted group in the United States. A Pew Forum poll, however, in 2007 found that nearly 69% of Americans identify themselves as Christian, some form of Christianity. Another survey from Pew that was conducted much more recently found 86% of the current Congress, the 112th Congress, members are Christian. So where does the idea of being a persecuted minority come from when the numbers don't seem to support that conclusion?
Where it comes from, I think, is very complicated. And it's tempting, I think, for me to say, I find that idea irresponsible and almost dangerous. There's a story, an essay in this book about a very fundamentalist youth movement called Teen Medium, also known as Battle Cry. And the leader of this movement, Ron Luce, sort of a rising star in that kind of Christian right political world, is fond of saying that we are approaching a point where only 4% of Americans will be Christians. And of course, he's redefining what is a Christian. A Christian has to really toe the line according to what he believes economically, politically, socially, as well as religiously. And he uses those numbers to create this idea that they are an embattled minority. So as Ron Luce told me, I'm a journalist. He said, I see you as a cultural terrorist. And lest I misunderstand and think that he meant that as a metaphor, he said, that's not a metaphor. You're no different than Al-Qaeda. Everywhere we are under attack, and he would illustrate this for his thousands and thousands of young followers. With he has big concert rallies and screens and big movie screens and pyrotechnics and rock bands and so on. And there'd be videos of suicide bombers of young Christian men, usually men, sort of multiplying and becoming an army. He really wanted to take that culture war metaphor and make it as concrete as he could. And it's a way of motivating the troops. We're under siege. Time to fight back. Well, they're not under siege. And it's time for them to take their responsible place, I think, and the broader community.
You have crisscrossed the nation, not just for this book, but for your short nonfiction pieces, reporting that you've been doing for many years now, hearing people's personal spiritual experiences, observing religious traditions and rites, even participating in some of them yourself. Given that background, what do you think the future of religion in America it looks like on the personal level, on the public level?
I guess I would resist that question again, and this has to do with the way I write and the way I think, especially writing about religion. And I think I learned my lesson, my first book, Killing the Buddha, and I was writing about a gathering of military pagans, paganism, fast-growing religion in the military, in Kansas. I was writing about a ritual to draw down the moon, and it was late at night, and the four witches, self-described, doing this, were naked. I was not. I was cold. I was standing there. I was shivering, and I couldn't help myself. I started to laugh. The head crone, as she was called, former member of the Air Force, wasn't bothered at all. Her daughter said, he's going to make fun of you. And she said, no, he's not going to make fun of us. He's not going to make fun of us. And we exist outside his writing. And if he thinks this is funny, he should laugh. So I think that kind of, that's been sort of my guide, is to sort of be very much close to the moment and not project. There's always that surprising moment when you find yourself out in a field with witches performing this ritual, and you're giggling because it seems absurd, and you realize in that situation, you're the fool. You're the one who doesn't get it. I couldn't have predicted that. And I couldn't have predicted that American religious life would lead me to that spot. So I'm hesitant to say anything about the future. I'd rather tell stories about it as it happens.
Jeff Charlotte is a journalist, the author most recently of Sweet Heaven, When I Die, Faith, Facelessness, and the Country in Between. Jeff, thank you for being with us on All Things Considered.
Thank you, Brandon.